The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Leeds.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Leeds. Tim McKenna is off this week. If you're counting, which I sort of am, this is show number 250. Now, who would have thunk that we would be on the air for 4.5 years and have almost 700 interviews in our archives? Well, it's true. And in a mini celebration of that, I thought I'd bring back two interviews that were both a lot of fun and offer up some thoughtful and interesting perspectives about our little world of bicycling. As you will hear, there were a lot of plans then that have come to fruition now, as well as some poison darts no one saw coming that have changed the face of cycling forever. Both of these interviews are from 2011. So if you are newer to the show and have never gone back into the archives and delved deeply, you may have missed these two gems. First up is Michael David Eisner. If you remember the Red Zinger Classic, which became the Coors Classic, then you might know of Michael. He is an inductee into the Bicycling Hall of Fame and is not a competitive cyclist. He's a true Renaissance man, though, as you will hear in our conversation. Michael has a most amazing outlook on life, and he shares it with us in this conversation. My second interview, also from 2011, is with Gary Helfrich. Now, some folks believe he is the father of titanium in our bicycle world, and many know him from his very coveted frame-building jig, Arctos. But some of my favorite things about Gary are his connections to people like Frank Zappa and Aerosmith. And today, he is one of those movers and shakers who understand how government, urban planning, and cycling can and even sometimes do come together. I hope you enjoyed this encore presentation of the Outspoken Cyclist. Let's tune into my conversation with Michael Eisner from March 2011. Michael Eisner, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this evening.
Thank you. This is incredibly exciting, having heard it, and now here we are.
Here we are. So what's going on in Boulder today?
Boulder, Colorado is always exciting. I had a wonderful lunch this afternoon with Davis Finney, who's just doing really well. I saw him last night at a presentation here in town for a velodrome, which is being proposed by a local bike shop owner. And he has found the ground and is fixing on a 250-meter velodrome that sits out in Erie, Colorado, and kind of had a gathering of us last night to talk to us about things. And Davis was there. It was nice to see him. And Andy Hampston and a number of other great racers were there, amongst other luminaries from Boulder. And then tomorrow we're going to gather at another velodrome here in town, the little indoor mini one that we've got. There's a little tiny track that a guy stuffed inside a warehouse that's absolutely great, and we're going there to have a fundraiser for a memorial, not a memorial, a monument that is being built in North Boulder Park to the Red Zinger Coors Bicycle Classic.
Wow, so that's your race, dude.
It's incredible, yep.
That's your race. So I'm going to just backtrack one second before we move on. So we actually are in the same process of trying to get a velodrome built here in Northeast Ohio, but we do not have the rarefied air of people like Davis Finney and Andy Hampston. I have to say, I understand why Boulder is the bicycling mecca when I hear names like that. So you mentioned it, and that's where I want to start. You were the race director of this Redzinger Coors Classic.
Yeah, you know, I wandered into the founder of Celestial Seasonings one day. I had just gotten back from the baby seal hunt off the coast of Labrador. I think I was probably 24 years old. And the CEO, founder of Celestial Seasonings, was my age, was really interested in wanting to know more about it. So he sought me out, and we had a lunch. And during lunch, he said, "Would you like to be doing some public relations, like the kind of stuff that you just did on this whole killing of the baby seal campaign, the anti-campaign against
Thank
it.
You. I was wondering where that was going. You didn't
that
actually say that. Okay, good, good.
Yeah, I was working with the International Fund for Animal Welfare.
Good.
And we went up to Labrador and were very involved in that. Took Bridget Bardot up there. And Mo had read about it in Life or Time magazine, and it was kind of my doing. And he was interested in having that kind of attention for this new bike race that he had just started a few years earlier. It had started in 75. This conversation that I'm talking to you about was in 77, and he asked me if I wanted to help working on a bike race. And I thought, you know, I'm so curious, I'm open for anything, I'd be happy to do it, but a bike race? I kind of didn't know what this thing was going to really be about. And the first bike race I ever saw was one that I had spent months and months promoting prior to that. And my first campaign was to convince a local movie theater company to distribute a little 12-minute short. That was back in the days when we would have short movies that appeared before the main feature.
Right.
And we created and shot at the 77 Redzinger Bicycle Classic, a little movie, and it was shot up in the mountains and great scenic backdrops and told a little story. And in 1978, it went into movie theaters on 35 millimeter, and people sat down to watch Jaws or Breaking Away, and up on the screen came a little 11-minute short of their town, of their mountains, the places where they go, and it's a deep inside look at this incredible bike race.
So you were able to get people to get behind it, like right from the get-go.
Right, I guess, right from the
sure.
get-go. You know what it was, Diane? It was just a matter of thinking differently. It was like, well, do I really just go after radio and television? Sure, I need to do that because that's how you reach people. But wait a minute. This is a bike race. It's in the mountains. It's magnificent. Movie theaters run shorts. It probably wouldn't cost us a lot to go shoot it if we did it internally on 16 millimeter. Wait a minute. Maybe I could just put those two ideas together. And I think it's just been a life of kind of trying to hammer together, mash together things like that that just simply make sense to me, that could help really make something bigger than life. And certainly putting the bike race up on the movie screen was that. And for Celestial Seasonings, here they are running this little bike race. Now people go sit down in movie theaters and they're seeing the name Celestial Seasonings all over the place, who didn't pay anything
right.
For this other than the making of this little movie. So that's how the relationship started, went on to 78. 79, I approached Mo Siegel, the founder of Celestial, and asked him, you know, told him my vision for how I wanted to see this thing grow. And he said, you know what, we don't have that money. We're going to be standing in your way. Let me make a phone call. And he did. He called Peter Coors in Denver and said, Peter, I want to pass the baton. This is perfect for you. You're a huge company. You're all about Colorado. We're all about Colorado. Why don't you take over the bike race? And I bought the race from Mo for $1, and we went off to the Adolf Coors Company and sponsorship for the next decade.
Right. From 80 to 88, it was the Coors International Bicycle Classic. Did it have any vestiges of the Redzinger anywhere? Did anything about the founding of that, did that go forward at all? Because I kind of remember the Redzinger days.
sure. Yes, of course. Listen, we were very protective of that. We were, especially in Colorado, I have to tell you, because Colorado loved, this was kind of the hippie era of the 70s.
Yes.
And they were not happy about the Coors Company. There were all these claims against the company about what they were doing with, checking people's locker for dope and not working well with gays and blacks and blah, 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 none of which was really true. But it was the kind of stuff that just seemed to be part of this momentum against the Adolph Coors Company. Unions really were the big issue at the time.
Right.
And Celestial was beloved by everybody. A guy started the company in the mountains picking herbs, and, you know, he was a hippie boy, and then all of a sudden he has this big company, and it's tea, it's not beer. So it naturally was an odd progression for us, but at the same time, Celestial Seasons established for this race the heartbeat that would continue forever hereafter.
Right.
And that heartbeat was graphics, was merchandise that had beautiful graphics on it.
Oh, I do remember that. Oh, yeah. Right? You had great posters, and all kinds of cool stuff.
That became a huge part of our success.
Sure.
To edit ahead, I need to tell you that by our final 2 years of the Coors Classic, we did $1 million, and the year after that, $1.5 million in the sales of Coors Classic concession items and merchandise worldwide.
Which would even today be a great number for a bicycle race?
Well, there's nobody come close. So we've talked to, that dropped right off the map when Trump and the DuPont race
right.
took place. They simply didn't really pay attention to that. Our organization had 13 full-time people doing nothing but calling bike stores and regular mass retailers, and our products were very diverse. We tried to stay out of the cycling world. We went to things that we thought would just be attractive to your average consumer. We created magazines that were, 96 pages long, perfect bound in color, sold them at grocery stores. We created calendars, and so our innovation were in the mainstream as opposed to just selling through bike stores. But we were hugely successful at that, and that legacy all stems back to Celestial Seasonings. And there was a love and passion for cycling, which we wanted to carry through into the Coors days. So everything that Mo had bestowed upon us in the early days, we think that we had expanded on that and kept the mantle of that right through to the very end.
So where do you think it all went wrong for cycling in the U.S., that we had this fabulous event, which everybody knew about? The Coors Classic was worldwide well-known. And then everybody tried to do a little something. Philadelphia was doing something, and there was DuPont, and there was... Now Amgen is doing a pretty nice job. But what happened, Michael?
Well, you're painting a picture of it being doomy and gloomy. I think that that the Coors Bicycle Classic, which was the fourth largest race in the world, it was the largest women's race in the world. We've never seen a race of this magnitude that treated women with the kind of respect that we did. So there are a lot of things that we did right. But you look at the Tour of California. It's using major California markets, many of which we path found, if that's a word, in the early days, San Francisco and Sonoma and Sacramento. These were places that, the Coors Classic ventured out to and were successful in our endeavor of getting into those areas in a good way.
But we're talking 30 years later.
If we're going to look today at the face of cycling, I think that it really comes down to economics. It's about sponsorship and about the fact that companies have to be convinced to spend millions of dollars for a certain return on their investment.
That's true.
I
understand. As
we say now in sponsorship, return on engagement. What is it that they get back in exchange for having spent an awful lot of money? Now, let's look at the economics. The Coors International Classic in its grandest day, 16-day bike race that started in Hawaii and went to California, from there to Nevada and across to Colorado with NBC television, cost $800,000.
Okay, you couldn't even do 3 days of that now.
Tour of California, right. the budget is somewhere around $12 million, somewhere between $10 and $12 million if you add in TV or not. So that's $1 million a day
right.
that those guys spend to make that bike race happen. You know, the dollars in Missouri were $500,000 a day. So there is a scale in there that's interesting. And I was just out talking to the Redlands folks, and they conduct a bike race in California, in the Los Angeles area, point to point, have been doing it for 20-something years, and they have all the same things that the Tour of California does, and they do it for $13,000 a day. Now, there's huge differences, prize list differences, road costs are pretty similar, except that the Redlands race gets them for free. So there's all these variables that are in there that make it kind of not comparable, but at the same time, this all has to be paid for. Ultimately, there needs to be a Coors or a Celestial Seasonings, a DuPont, a Trump, a benefactor like Quiznos here in Colorado, like the two owners who are putting up $10 million for this event. That's the critical component here. It's not an inexpensive sport. The stadium for cycling is not in some enclosed area where you can get gate receipts.
That's true.
The stadium for cycling is out on the streets, and when you close them, you A, inconvenience people, and B, cost yourself a lot of money in police and service costs in order to be able to even conduct the event. So it costs a lot of money. It's expensive.
All right. Let me just remind our listeners. We're talking with Michael Eisner, who is the race director, was the race director for the Coors International Bicycle Classic, who is an amazing promoter and understand cycling in a very different way from a lot of other people who try to put on events. So you alluded to it. You said it. What's going on with Quiznos? What is this?
So this race, the Quiznos race, is an event that was started with a telephone call. Lance Armstrong sitting up in Aspen. And there was a chance that he may not have gotten into the Tour de France a couple years ago, and he thought to himself, well, what should I do? He's talking to Chris Carmichael, and the two of them decide, well, let's start a bike race. Well, wait a minute, we're here in Colorado. Why don't we just get the Coors Classic going again? Chris Carmichael, who's his coach, rode in the Coors Classic and was a successful, great racer in it. And so they decided, well, let's go right to the top. And Lance picks the telephone up and calls the governor of Colorado.
Now, well, of course
now
he
I'll
does.
Tell you the story from the governor's side.
Okay.
The governor tells me that he's sitting at his desk, and he's worried about fiscal budget issues and reelection. The phone rings. Secretary says, Lance Armstrong's on the phone. He kind of looks at the phone like, okay, Lance Armstrong's calling me. Wonder what that's about. Wow, how that's interesting. Yes, I'll take the call. Takes the call. Lance says, we need another bike race. Are you the guy? He says, great. Anything with you, Lance? Let's meet. Lance comes down. They talk to him. And the governor picks the phone up and gets through another person, gets me into his office. I help him with a feasibility study on whether this thing looks like it could happen again, comparing costs from the old days to today. And he loved the idea. He brings in some friends who bring in Quiznos. Quiznos loves the idea, and then Quiznos takes over the concept entirely and is funding fully the bike race. The two owners of Quiznos and they're, you know, a guy and his dad, and they are the ones that are bankrolling it in hopes of getting some of the funding back. But they've got Quiznos, the company they own, to sponsor the race, to be the title sponsor. And, of course, there'll be other vendors involved in it. They've announced a six-day race, starts in Colorado Springs, goes up through Salida and Gunnison, Crested Butte, Avon, Steamboat Springs, Breckenridge, and back to the Denver area. And that's it. It's another, you know, stage race that's on the horizon. We have to keep these things alive. And this harkens back to your question of, well, what happened? Where are they going? We've seen them disappear. It's not that Philadelphia is there. Philadelphia is still there after 26 years. This race rocks on. It's a great event. But there have been many great events that have disappeared. Georgia is gone. Missouri is gone. And the list is long. And that is because I think, personally, we don't pay attention to the real ingredients of our responsibility as promoters to do what we have to do for the sponsors in order to be able to ensure that they can't leave the event because you're performing so well for them.
So this is going to be, it says August of 2011. So it really is happening this year.
Yes. going to happen, and the only course that they're using of the old Coors Classic days is up in Vail.
Okay.
And we are planning right now, is in Vail a couple of days ago, we are planning to have a Coors Classic Red Zinger 30-year or 35-year reunion.
Very cool.
Up in Vail on the night of the 25th, so that's going to be a lot of fun. And also the movie American Flyers. It's been 30 years since that movie was released with Kevin Costner. It was shot at the Coors Classic.
Right. So will you have inside this Quiznos Pro Challenge a master's race with any of you guys? Any of
no.
the guys?
No, there won't be a race. There will be a time trial up there, and these guys will probably do a little bit of a parade or something like that. But you know what? They've moved on. A lot of the pros and the winners have kind of
True.
Moved on in their life and are doing other things. But they're going to get up there. They're going to definitely have a ride for sure and have these guys back and honor the legacy of the bike race.
So what else are you doing, Michael Eisner?
Oh, boy. That's a crazy question. I just got back from Los Angeles consulting with a group who is planning on putting boots back on the lunar surface within the next decade. I'm working with Dr. Jane Goodall, and I'm editing a movie that I shot at the Tour de France. And I'm consulting with Red Bull on a project that they're doing coming up.
I'm sorry, and you're just not busy enough for me, Michael.
There's just a
I'm
lot
sorry.
Of stuff going on. On top of that, one of the most exciting parts of my life is that I chase total solar eclipses. And I will be doing my 10th total solar eclipse in 2012 in July. And that will be in Australia, so that'll be a lot of fun. But I spend a lot of my time consulting and helping startups. I'm working with a group here in Colorado on a new startup that they've got to kind of just keep their vision right and look at things from a high visibility, a broad perspective, so that they can really march down the road doing the right things.
So you're also one of the non-competitive U.S. Cycling Hall of Famers.
You know what? That was such a treat for me to go there and to have that happen. I loved it. It was back east. I've since hosted one of the dinners that they had at their new location out in Davis, and I just could not be prouder of that. I love that.
Yeah, I know other Hall of Famers who are quite interesting, like John Howard.
Yes,
one of my favorite people and somebody I've known for many, many years.
And the first winner of the Red Zinger Bicycle Classic,
yes,
by the
he
way,
was.
2 years in
that,
a row. So.
That is true. That is true.
Go.
See, so what goes around comes around.
That's it.
Yeah. So besides Quiznos, besides the Coors, there are some interesting stories about Michael Eisner. Something about spiders, tarantulas? Is that really true? Did you have them on your desk? Please tell me.
Well, not only did I have them on my
God,
desk, I still
true.
Have them on my desk.
Do you really?
I sent you a nice picture today of one of my
tarantulas. Oh, I haven't seen it yet.
Named Miss Carpenter after Connie Carpenter.
Sure.
Nice red hair. But I've always loved tarantulas and bugs and spiders and insects of all kinds. My walls are filled with insects from around the world. Just fascinating creatures. I am a totally and completely nature-curious person. I look at my life from the moon, from out there on this little planet, and I've got a fraction of a second of time to enjoy what's going on here. And the fascination of all the machinations of nature are the kind of thing I could literally spend every day doing nothing but looking at.
You know what's interesting is you're sort of this Renaissance guy, and Michael Shermer, Mr. Skeptic, has some interesting things to say. I think cycling produces some very brilliant people.
You know what? I got to tell you, I was with Michael Shermer 3 days ago in Los Angeles. He is a great friend. I could not admire his words, his position, and his intellect more. And I was thinking the other day that he's probably the smartest graduate from cycling. We have them in many different forms. We've got the Gary Fisher type. We've got the Davis Finney type. We were talking about the fact that that Davis spent most of his time, I remember going to his room when he was a top competitive racer, and you'd open up the door, and in his room, he would be sitting in there reading.
Sure.
And he would be telling you about some book that he read. Nowadays, you go into the rooms and all the kids are on their Facebook, you know,
right,
looking
yeah.
at. Right. And you have Eric Heiden that's gone on
right.
in the medical world. I mean, the list is long. Ron Kiefel out here is running a bike store and is a brilliant businessman. We just have so many interesting people that have come from this sport. Shermer is at the top of my list.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I wanted to introduce a whole new generation of cycling people who may not know who you are to you. And so I really appreciate that you took time tonight to talk to us about the Coors, about the Quiznos, about your perspective on racing and cycling. And so my last question is, how are they going to clean up racing, Mr. Eisner?
Yeah, you know what? It's a hard sport. And Diane, you hit on the nose the key question. And what to say about that? It is a quandary, and the quandary is built on the fact that it's a hard sport and that it started going down a dirty path. And to reverse that process, the consequences have to be significant and huge, and they have to be uniform. And I think we're in the process of cleaning the sport up. But, you know, there's two ways to do anything like this, and I think we can look at the problem of drugs in sports the same as we can look at the reason why 14-year-olds sit around on couches, smoking dope and playing Wii and being unmotivated with their lives and not exploring their lives and nature with their own senses that they've been given. And I think that's just a part of a general a malaise, a process that we're going through. And it's a big question about how we can, in a way, erase these things. There's two ways to do it. One way is to just tell people you can't do it and keep the products away from everybody and make the consequences huge. And the other one is to address the actual reason why people gravitate towards doing those kinds of things in the first place. And I think that we're not doing that part of it well. We're not really exploring deeply inside the real genesis for why people move in that direction. We know that it's a tough sport, and we know that if they can add something to their bloodstream that will allow them to be able to ensure a good position with their team or success, we get that part of it. But we need to find out more about how we can change that process from the inside instead of just penalize people and see them bounced out of the sport besmirched. So I it's a tough one. I can't give you a flippant, patented answer to it, but I know that it's something, I feel that it is something that the sport is working on and trying to turn around from the inside.
I think that's
and
a good, honest answer.
We need a lot
answer.
Of help.
Yeah, well, there's a self-esteem issue in here somewhere, it sounds like.
For someone to have accomplished a task and go to sleep and feel good about what they've done, and know that they have done it artificially or that they've been boosted in some way or it's an experience that they've gotten through, you know, some substance or chemical change in their body or their head or state change that's been put upon them as opposed to something that they've generated themselves by themselves. I just don't know how great you can feel about yourself. And I think there's a lot to that. And I think when I lecture a lot to young kids about drugs and things like that, most often default to that in the conversation. How good are you going to feel about this? In your last 10 minutes of life, when you look back at the accomplishments that you've had, are you going to just look back at those things that you simply did, the record books, or are the ones that you're really proud of and can pride really come from being artificially jacked to accomplish a certain task? And that's the question that I kind of dwell on.
Wow. Okay, then. I think you're absolutely right. And I'm not sure how it's going to pan out at the end. But
right.
I like to ask the question. I like to hear the different answers. I think you've brought up a point that I have never heard before, and that's that from the inside out.
And that's why I look at Davis Finney's wins and look at his life and know how great he feels about his massive accomplishments and great number of wins that he accomplished, because he can say that it was all about him. It was about his head, his legs, his lungs, his emotions, everything that he did to pace himself so that when he came across that line, he was first. And that's what it's about.
Okay, then. What a great note to end, huh? Michael, thank you so much.
By the way, just a reminder that there is very often people saying, well, I've never had a chance to see what the race looks like, the old days, and there's a 3-DVD set that's out, a Red Singer Coors Classic 3-DVD compilation.
And how can people get that?
Put out by Velo Gear. They've recently been purchased by another company. I don't know what their new name is right now, but if they just go to velogear.com, I think is where it was in the past. So
very cool.
There you go. And it's a beautiful compilation of all the CBS and NBC coverage of the race and all that stuff.
So. And you get to see all these cool guys.
That's it.
All right. Michael, have a wonderful night.
Thank you
Thank
so
you
much.
So much for spending time with me, and we'll catch up with you again.
Terrific.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
My interview with Michael Eisner was recorded in March of 2011. So as a quick update, Michael just returned to Boulder after announcing his 31st straight Philly bike race. He is also one of the forces behind the new U.S. Cycling Monument in Boulder, Colorado, that is being planned by the Play Boulder Foundation. You can find out more about this sculpture and how it will be a celebration of the famed Red Zinger and Coors Classic Series, and especially the final stage for the race over 10 years in North Boulder Park at uscyclingmonument.com. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with my interview with Sonoma Bikes' Gary Helfrich from November 2011. You are listening to an encore presentation of The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit doddcamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
I'm Diane Lees, and you are listening to an encore presentation of my show from 2011. The following interview was recorded in November of 2011 with the director of SonomaBike.org's Gary Helfrich. I think you will find him a most fascinating guy. Gary Helfrich, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Thank you. Glad to be on.
Yeah, I'm very excited to talk to you. My partner Brian says, you got to talk to Gary Helfrich. He's really an important guy. So,
I'm glad he and my mother both believe that.
Yeah, see, it's important to have a couple people in your camp. So I need to confess that after doing preliminary research, I didn't even know where to begin. You have done so many things. So I'm going to start with what you're doing now, and then we'll kind of backtrack into some of the fun things you've done in the past. So tell us a little bit about you and BikeSonoma.org.
Okay. Currently, I'm the executive director of Sonoma County Bicycle Coalition, and that's known around here as Bike Sonoma. And I've only been doing this for 6 months.
Oh.
So I'm relatively new to this. This is kind of a new phase in my life. I was the county transportation planner for 6 years before that.
So Sonoma is, just put it in space, where in California is the Sonoma area?
It is on the coast.
Okay.
We grow a little bit of wine here.
Yeah.
You probably know about that.
Yeah, I do.
And it's a moderately large county that begins about 50 miles north of San Francisco.
Okay.
And runs up to Mendocino.
Beautiful country.
It is.
Which means there's good cycling up there.
There's phenomenal cycling here.
Okay. So what exactly is your role with the organization? What do you do, actually? And what does the organization do?
What I do as director, I'm the administrator. I make sure that I find money for us to run our organization. I work with Sandra Lupien, who is our outreach director, on our position on various advocacy issues. And I work with cities, there's 9 cities in this county, and the county on implementing the projects that are in their bicycle plans.
Okay, so how did you get involved with this? And then we'll back into what you did before, which is just amazing to me, all the things you've done.
Well, I got laid off from the county.
Aha!
Well, a more serious answer to that is I made a decision and this had nothing to do with bicycling, but I got very, very, very involved in local government and went back to college, got a degree in planning, and got the position with the county as the county's transportation planner. So I did the plan for our road network, for our airports. I did the, you know, airport land use master plan. I wrote the bicycle and pedestrian plan. Worked with SMART, which is a project to reestablish rail transit here. So Sonoma County has the biggest city in the United States, Santa Rosa, that's ever lost rail service.
Oh, man.
So that kind of puts us in it.
That's an interesting place to be, yeah.
And it's an interesting statistic. I didn't realize that Santa Rosa was the biggest city to lose rail service. And we've recently reestablished freight service, and we're working on passenger. And the unique thing about this, where it fits into my current job, is this is the first time ever anywhere that someone has proposed a rails with trails project to bring back a railroad.
What a great idea. We have something here in the Cuyahoga Valley where you can throw your bike on the train and then ride the towpath nearby, but certainly not on a scale that I think you're talking about.
This would let you go from Cloverdale in the north end of our county all the way down to the ferry to San Francisco.
Nice.
That's 70 miles, and it's a parallel path about 50 feet away from where the train is running. So you, and the train will carry your bike as well, so you can get on and off any place you want and ride your bicycle along the same route that the train takes.
Well, all those tracks are still there, right?
The tracks never got torn up.
Okay.
And we were fortunate there, but often what happens with abandoned rail lines is you get rid of the rail and just put a bike path in.
Okay, so it converts rails to trails. That's what that
right,
program is.
Right, but this is rails with trails.
I think that's such
and
a
that's
cool
really
idea.
That's really unique.
That is unique, and it's a great idea. Now if they could just do rails, trails, freeways, we'd be in great shape.
Well, we are doing a freeway with trails project. Funny you should ask.
Funny I should ask. That's great. So is this another, like, only place in the country?
No, this has been done in other places, and it often happens for the same reason. We have an old, outdated freeway that, to get the federal money that we need, has to be realigned. And so rather than just throw out the old pavement, the old alignment will become a dedicated bike and pedestrian path, and the new freeway will go its happy way. What makes this interesting is it's an area that has so few connections that legally you can ride your bike on the freeway because there isn't any alternative to get between these two cities of Novato and Petaluma. You literally have to ride your bicycle on the freeway.
Okay.
It's kind of exciting.
Yeah. It's kind of terrifying, too. Oh, Greg says it's common in the West, that is not an unusual situation.
It's true.
Okay.
And as somebody, you know, I grew up in Boston.
Right.
I was kind of terrified by it, but it turns out, especially once I began to work for the county and had access to our accident statistics, it's statistically extremely safe. You just have to get used to trucks flying by at 75 miles an hour while you're riding your bike.
Yeah, I guess. How many lanes? Are we talking a regular freeway, like six lanes?
Three lanes in each direction.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, then. Interesting. Obviously, bicycle and pedestrian issues are part of what you're doing. Are you also getting involved with legislation? What's going on in Washington at all?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
we're involved at, I guess I'd say, all in California, it's all four levels. There's national, there's state, there's regional, which is unusual. California has these councils of government that create transportation regulations and disperse money regionally, and then at the local level as well. So, yeah, and I'm a little bit disturbed that our normally very liberal Senator Barbara Boxer seems to be caving in.
We reported a little bit on that this week. That's where they were marking up the transportation bill. What did she say? What is she caving to?
Well, Boxer is certainly one of the most liberal members of the United States Senate. And when the Republicans praise something that she's doing,
you get suspicious.
I get uneasy, you know. Or if John Boehner says that she has an excellent proposal, which was also said,
that
doesn't sit well. And I don't, you know, we don't yet. We're still trying to figure out what the heck happened.
Me too. I've been reading it all this week and still can't figure it out.
Because transportation funding is only a couple of percent of the whole federal budget, all transportation put together. And bicycle and pedestrian is 1% of that. You're not talking about an amount of money that's more than, say, a rounding error in the defense budget.
Right.
or that could keep Social Security going for more than 15 minutes.
Exactly.
It's not enough money to make a difference. It's not as if bike and ped projects were preventing roads from being improved.
Right.
Well, we're going to be having a talk.
Are you? Good. Good
all,
for you.
The California Bike Co. We have a statewide umbrella organization that's very, very good at lobbying, and they'll be meeting with Senator Boxer just to see what the heck happened.
So I just want to take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Gary Helfrich, who's out in Sonoma County. And now we're going to back a little bit into who he was before he became the director of the organization, BikeSonoma.org. So you aren't from the West Coast. You already said you were from Boston. Tell us what...
Even worse, I grew up in New Jersey.
New Jersey?
Yes. I grew up in a suburb of Newark.
Okay.
Which was kind of New Jersey's answer to Detroit.
Nice. Greg's laughing. I'm not so sure that's a good thing to say. So,
we have listeners in both those places, Diane, so just be careful.
Okay.
I enjoyed growing up there, and I learned never to trust air that you can't see.
Okay. Okay. That's a good one. I like that one. So, I'm going to ask you what brought you to the coast and how you ended up leaving that area.
Well, I've always been at the coast.
West Coast. Sorry. The left coast. How's the left coast?
Newark has got a harbor. And
you're
so
right.
Does Boston.
You're right. Of course it does.
I had, it was more just to get some distance from some business partners that I had.
Got it.
We had to split up. We were all pretty young, all of us who started Merlin, which was a company that built titanium bicycles.
Yeah, we're going there.
But, you know, we weren't really ready to run a business. So the partnership fell apart.
Okay.
I moved out here because I knew a lot of people in Sonoma County, and I had lived in Southern California before and knew that, you know, to carry the Detroit analogy further, if you took Detroit, hit it with a fly swatter, you'd get Los Angeles. Just spread it out.
Just spread it out. Yep. It is sprawling.
Well, and in the 70s, it was nasty.
Yeah.
I mean, Los Angeles has gone through a renaissance. I was just down there for the California Bicycle Summit.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, but go ahead.
Oh, that the city is gorgeous now. I mean, they've gone
nice.
Through a complete renaissance.
Nice.
It was not gorgeous in the 70s.
No, it was not. So you went out. You went out there. You left Boston and the Merlin people. And tell me where Arctos Machines came in. Your fabulous jig that the frame builders still say is one of the finest on the market.
It's from the Latin name for Manzanita, Arctostophilus.
Okay.
It was the only thing that would grow in our yard for a while.
Okay. I'm trying to figure this out, you know? Anyway, you have been referred to as the mad scientist and a brilliant metallurgist.
Somebody called me an underachieving genius.
Well, I think a lot of people are underachieving geniuses, but I don't know
if I'd call myself mad yet. I was.
Wait, you were and you're not yet. So
right. That was before I did bicycles. When I did other things.
Okay, like crazy things.
Yeah.
Like you were a groupie for Aerosmith. No, you were a roadie for Aerosmith.
No, groupie, that's a different genre.
You're right. Yeah, you're right.
They perform a different function.
Yeah. Okay, we're not going there.
Yeah.
You were a roadie, though.
I actually ran the road crew.
And so how did that happen? I think that's a really cool story.
I was 19 years old and was going to college, just started going to college.
Where?
And at Emerson in Boston.
Yep.
It was a theater arts school. And was working, doing sound at a nightclub, Paul's Mall. And so I got an offer to, so here was what was facing me was, you're 19 years old. Do you want to go back to school for the next semester or go off with a rock and roll band and snort your body weight in coke every week?
Let's
see. It
takes
about 30 seconds to make that decision when you're 19.
Okay.
So that was it. It was like running off with a circus.
Exactly. And I would imagine a rock band is sort of like a circus. How long did you do that?
Well, I did that for 10 years. I didn't work for them for 10 years. You are only working when they're on the road.
Right.
And when they're in the studio, there's other folks involved. And so I went out on the road with a pretty wide variety of bands. I mean, the range from Frank Zappa to, on the other hand, the Captain and Tennille.
Wait a minute. Did you really travel with Frank Zappa?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I built a PA. In fact, this was one of the most fun jobs I had, was to build a PA system that was going to be used at... There was a traditional Halloween concert that happened in Los Angeles, and so we made a PA system that looked like a pumpkin, like a pile of gigantic pumpkins.
Cool. I am a huge Frank Zappa fan.
Well, good. No one has ever asked me what it was like, though, to listen to Muskrat Love every night.
Well, I guess anything can get old if you listen to it long enough, huh?
Well, that was the Captain and Tennille.
I can't diss Captain and Tennille. They were popular when they were, but they sure weren't Frank Zappa. And the mothers of invention.
There were lots of... Just popularity doesn't make something good. I mean, otherwise, Thomas Kinkade would be Rembrandt.
That's a good point. Very good. So, you know what I want to talk about now, don't you?
Bicycles.
I do want to talk about bicycles, but not a whole lot. I want to talk about the Dumpster Classic.
Oh, that was held in my backyard.
Well, explain what it was. I used to call it something else. There was something called a Huffy Toss years ago.
Well, the Huffy Toss was a completely different and separate event that happened in Bolton, Vermont.
Okay.
The Huffy Toss was actually more epic than the Dumpster Classic. The Dumpster Classic occurred because my backyard in Somerville it's a good thing the EPA never discovered. I guess when machines were used up in the shop at Fat City, they just went into my backyard.
I see.
It was a lot cheaper than actually getting rid of them. And so we at first set up a trials course, and then we decided to set up a whole criterium course around the house and through the backyard and through the junk and into the basement shop and out again. And a lot of people were seriously injured, and that's just part of the fun.
Uh-huh.
The crowd was encouraged to shoot bottle rockets at people as they came around.
Oh, jeez.
Enormous amounts of alcohol and other substances were involved.
It sounds like it. It would have to be.
And we had some fun events, like it's the first and only time that I was able to beat Joe Murray in a hill climb.
And that's because he was disabled?
Well, no, we said, why don't we do it like horse racing, where everyone races at the same weight?
Ah.
And I'm been accused of being gravitationally challenged. And I said, how about we're going to use as the racing weight 300 pounds. You and your bike, we just put weight on your bike.
Sure.
Until you and your bike weigh 300 pounds.
Got it.
Well, I can hit that with a cruiser in about 10 pounds. In the basket.
Got it.
With Joe, it's like double his body weight
right.
on the bike.
Right.
And we just did a one block hill climb, and he couldn't keep the bike upright. Which is why.
Okay. Well, let's talk about this titanium bike that you heaved. Didn't you heave a titanium bike in your dumpster classic?
Oh, yeah. Well, although most of the heaving happened at the Huffy Puffy Toss. That's where we did the serious heaving.
Okay.
We did flatten a titanium bike and put it in the wall of somebody's house.
Oh, really?
And that one we called the flat chance. Because this was before we started Merlin. We were all still working at Fat City.
Yeah, at Fat City. Oh, my goodness. Is it still in the house?
I think so. It was in Gwyn's house, who was one of the partners in Merlin.
Right. Does Gwyn still live
in
the house?
In the wall of his house.
Does Gwyn still live in the house?
I don't know.
Wow, that's hilarious.
But I'll bet you it's still in the wall of the house.
So that means that's like, you know, tearing down your walls and finding money in your house. Now you're going to find this titanium frame. Is it the whole bike or just a frame?
Just a frame.
Cool.
But, you know, it's only 3 pounds of titanium, so.
Yeah. It's not worth much.
I don't know, it's worth $100.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Maybe.
Exactly. Yeah, except for its classic value that it was built during such an interesting era.
That's true, but the actual intact rideable bikes seem to be more valuable.
Yeah, okay. Well, I guess we should talk a little bit about what you see for the future of bicycling, regardless of what happened back in Somerville. Do you see that we're going to ever get bicycling as the national pastime it used to be? I mean, for people to not just recreate and commute and ride and race. You know, bicycling has so many little spokes on its hub. It's hard for people to pigeonhole it. And so I'm afraid it's never going to be well received by everybody, especially drivers.
Well, here's what I hope is going to happen, is that in the future, everybody will have transportation choice. That you won't be obligated to use a car. You use a car because you want to use a car. Right now, driving is an obligation. You basically can't work in the United States in most places unless you own a car.
That's true.
I mean, the exception would be some place like New York City that is just really dense and has phenomenal public transit. But, you know, you combine that, which I really see is going to be the future, with a growing awareness that active transportation is probably the single biggest key to taking care of our public health epidemic we have with obesity and heart disease. And it's from a sedentary lifestyle. And you know, this is what drives me crazy about things like electric cars. All electric cars are going to do is take care of the pollution problem. And even then, if you're, say, in the Midwest with a coal-fired power plant, it might be worse. You know, you're going from gasoline to coal. I mean, why not operate a steam locomotive?
Yeah, that's true. So,
you know, some places, we did the calculations here because everybody says, ooh, we'll put up solar panels. In our little county here, which only has 500,000 people in it, we would have to put up almost 8,000 acres of solar panels to charge the electric cars if our whole fleet switched over to electric.
So how would you see this happening? I mean, obviously, you now have your rails and trails project and your rails and trails and freeway project. Do you think this will expand?
Well, here's the hardest thing about, you've kind of got two halves of the sustainability equation. And one half is how we live, and that is, you know, you have a well-insulated house, you use sustainable materials, things like that. But that's essentially consuming your way to sustainability. And then there's the part of where we live, and that's hard because that means we're going to have to change our habits, not just buy a Prius or, buy some PV. But I think people are going to do it simply because to not do it, the consequences are too dire. That I don't think people say, you know, I really like living 40 miles from where I work, and I love that hour and a half of time on the interstate that I get every day, just me and 30,000 other people stuck in traffic. I get off on that. People hate that. People don't want to be doing it. People want to spend time with their families. And the thing about active transportation, which is walking and biking both, is it's the only type, you know, transit's not the answer. Transit is part of the answer. But the problem with transit is it still encourages great distances between where you work and where you live and a disconnect from your community.
So you're saying people are going to have to move back in toward the city, that these outer ring suburbs are going to shrink a little, and this rural thinking is also going to shrink?
Well, or the other way around, that you're going to move. It's generally easier to get a little bit creative with your zoning and allow businesses to move near to residential areas.
Aha.
Getting people to pick up and move their household is a lot harder because there's a lot of emotion involved with that. And a business is just whether or not it pencils out. If it makes sense, a business will make a decision just based on the money.
That's true.
So if you've got a concentrated workforce somewhere, generally speaking, I mean, what keeps businesses where they are is just land use regulations. And we aren't in the era where having a job meant working in a mill somewhere. Usually, I mean, is, say, a software development company really incompatible with a residential subdivision?
Probably not.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't make any noise. It doesn't make any pollution. It has high-paying jobs. It would just mean that you would have your residential subdivision. It would have a low-rise office building in it that would employ a lot of the people that work there. And then that, in turn, would generate a lot of satellite businesses. I mean, the people need to go someplace to eat. Then you take the final step is then you need to finally make it a real place. You need a civic area. You need a town center. A lot of these ring suburbs aren't even incorporated in most places. I mean, they aren't municipal corporations. They're out in county land.
Living in the Cleveland area, it's not like that. So, I'm trying to understand what you're saying based on what I know. And so I don't know much outside of Northeast Ohio in terms of how government works with these suburbs. We are all incorporated and we're all beholden to Cleveland for water, for example. It's an interesting study. It's very different from what you're saying, but
right.
I can understand what you're saying. And it makes sense to me to create community around residents.
Well, and I look at almost the opposite is going back to Boston, where the place was so, eastern Massachusetts was so heavily developed so long ago that there really wasn't an opportunity for anything to sprawl. There wasn't any open space to sprawl to. I mean, centuries ago, those towns were built out right to the next town over.
Right.
So Massachusetts was lucky in that it has very, very self-contained medium to small-sized towns and cities that are economically independent from each other. I mean, that would be a nice place to be, but I don't know if we want to wait the 200 years or so it takes
exactly.
for that to evolve.
Exactly.
And then, the Midwest is kind of a middle ground where, here's an oddity in California, is it's not legal to create a village, a town, a borough. The only legal municipal corporation in California is a city.
And
period.
That requires so much population, right?
Exactly. And,
right.
And so what happens out here that's awful is you create these big, I think of them as population zits. and finally, you get 50,000 people or so living on septic systems out in the country, and that's enough people to be economically viable to incorporate, but then the whole city has been created without any planning, without any thought. It's
right.
just that enough people have coalesced in one area.
I
to
got
be,
it.
And there's enough property tax to support the thing, but it isn't really a city. It's just a place that a lot of people live.
And so there's nothing really to support it in terms of civic, like museums and, orchestras and...
Oh, no, I'm talking more basic, like schools.
Oh, even like schools. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Huh.
Or garbage collection. I mean, the real basics.
Yeah, basic stuff, sure. Well, you know what? I'll bet we could talk about this for the next 10 hours.
We could, and that's what I did for the last 6 years. I was a planner. And
got it.
I was on the policy side, so we did, our shop was the group that was responsible for developing land use regulations in the county, and it's something I'm fairly passionate about. The problem is in today's economy, those are the first long-range planning is always what you get rid of because it doesn't generate any permit fees.
I see. Well, I'm glad you came back to the bicycle side because I think you have a lot to add.
Well, I never left, really.
No, I guess not. Are you going to be at the bike summit?
I am.
Well, we should meet up and sit down and have another chat. How's that?
We should.
All right. Well,
absolutely.
It's been wonderful talking to you, getting to know you.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Gary.
Okay.
Have a great night.
You too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed this encore presentation of my interviews with Michael Eisner and Gary Helfrich. I'll be back with a brand new edition of The Outspoken Cyclist next week as we roll on into summer. I hope you have a great week and have an opportunity to go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.